Off the Ball Breakfast.
I have not seen a minute of this tournament.
That's what the cool kids say these days.
Genuinely haven't.
Everyone's saying that. I haven't seen a second of it.
It's not a thing. It hasn't even...
Live every weekday morning from 7:30 on your smart speaker. Just ask Alexa to play OTB Sports Radio.
Off the Ball Breakfast.
With UPMC Orthopaedic Care. When things don't move, rotate or bend like they used to, choose us to help you get back in action.
Yeah, you just have to be there.
You know, you had to be there.
It was just great to say, like, all right, I was there for that. You know what I mean?
You have to be there. I wish I wasn't there. You have to be there.
Right, a very special episode of You Had To Be There. Delighted to say documentary maker Ross Whittaker is with us. Ross, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Yeah, pretty good.
Good.
The busiest man in our showbiz at the moment. You've two films out.
Well, yeah, I mean, one film is in the cinema, so we've been obviously trying to get the word out on that. And then actually, just as timing would have it, we have a documentary on Sky Sports on Thursday night.
Okay.
Yeah, a golf documentary.
We'll come to the golf in a minute, but yeah. Beat the Lotto is the documentary. Are Irish feature-length documentaries making a comeback?
I don't know if they ever went away. Like, I mean, it's documentaries are always tough. Like, the truth is, people don't immediately think of them as something they go and see in the cinema. Like, we're coming out the same weekend as Jurassic Park. You know, that's a tricky kind of sell, you know what I mean? So, but there have been so many great ones over the years, and I think it's something that started about 15 to 20 years ago. There was an emphasis within our Irish funding body, Film Board, and then Screen Ireland, which is funded by the taxpayer and all the people that are listening to this, to put a bit more emphasis on documentaries. And that has sort of borne fruit over the years. It started slowly, and now I feel like we've got about 15 or 20 feature docs being made every year. And like, the thing about documentary is it is a bit different to going and seeing Jurassic Park, but also, like, docs, they really reflect society, either now or in the past, in a way maybe that you don't always get in fictional or drama films.
What's the challenge about making something about a period like 1992 when there must be some footage, but not all the footage you want?
Well, in this case, there actually was a lot of footage because we were so lucky that that particular story had really captured the imagination of the media and press at the time, which I suppose is quite different to now in that it wasn't so wall-to-wall, but there was still an RT reporter called Mark Little who went on to bigger things, I suppose. And he really was attracted to the story, and he followed the syndicate around getting as much as he could. So in terms of that, we were quite lucky, yeah.
Okay. So when did you hear about the story first? What?
Well, I remember it. Like, I was a kid in school, and I do remember it. But I was at a wedding, and I was asking this guy about, like, what he did and was there a documentary in it? Because sadly, I'm always on the lookout for documentaries. You know, some kind of failing that I now have. But I was chatting away to him, and he said, no, what you really need to make a documentary about is that time when the guys tried to fix the lottery, and the light bulb went off, because I went, that is a perfect story to be made into a film. It took me a while to persuade other people that it was a perfect story to make into a film, and that was over 10 years ago, but here we are now. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So
what's the distinction between that, you say, like, as opposed to turning it into a feature film as opposed to a documentary?
Yeah, I suppose, look, I'm a documentary maker, so when I think of a film, I think of a feature-length documentary a lot of the time, or if it's a story that's perfect to be an hour on TV, I'd think about it that way, you know, or whatever way you might think about it. But yeah, I suppose in this case, it has the same elements that you would want for a fictional film. You know, it's got a thriller element, takes place over a short period of time, it's got a ticking clock, like all those kinds of things. And then it builds to a climax, which, like, you know, obviously I've done a lot of sports documentaries over the years. And the great thing about sport is often you're building to, like, a moment, a final, whatever it might be. This was a bit like that, you know. On the Saturday night, they're either going to win or lose, depending on whether they could buy all of the tickets they wanted.
So we're not going to give the end away. You've got to go buy tickets in the cinema. What's it actually like having a film in the cinema? Is this your first cinema release?
No, it's fifth.
Right.
Jerry, you obviously haven't been paying attention. we started with Saviors in 2008. We did a film called Unbreakable about Mark Pollock about 2000. I'm starting to forget now. 2015, then 2016, we had Between Land and Sea, a surf doc.
Oh, yeah.
And then 2018, we made a film about a little-known boxer called Katie Taylor.
And that got a cinema release?
Yeah, that was released in cinemas, yeah.
I didn't realize.
She did pretty well in the cinema. Like, a lot of people went to see it. So, yeah, it's funny. I suppose, like, people, ultimately, even if you had the greatest cinema release of any documentary, like that might be 40,000 people go to see it in the cinema.
Right.
You know, a good broadcast on RTE is still 400,000 people. It's 10 times the numbers, you know what I mean? And if people are watching the All-Ireland Final, that's 1 million people, or the Six Nations is something like that too. So, you know, the numbers on TV, it's still by far the biggest way you can put a documentary out into the world.
But there is something about actually going to see your own thing in the cinema, the lights go down.
Yeah, and when you're making these films and they're feature length, like, there is a different technique to it, and you are attempting to make something that people will sit in a dark room and experience in a different way. They'll definitely, I suppose, get all the nuances and layers that they wouldn't normally get, or they wouldn't automatically get when they're watching on TV, and maybe there's a few more distractions around now more than ever, you know? So, and definitely would beat the lotto. Like, we really made it for the cinema, you know? It really unfolds like a thriller, like a bit of a caper, because there's plenty of humour in there too. So, you know, and that's the feedback we're getting. Like, people are like, oh God, I really need to tell everyone to go and see this on the big screen, because it is such a great experience in that way. It's really fun. People are getting that buzz, you know, because there's a lot of laughs in there. So you're getting that kind of collective experience of enjoying those laughs with an audience, yeah. You know, which is a bit different.
No, totally different. I think that, like, we might take cinema for granted because it could so easily disappear. Like, it's so cheap for people to have a 50-inch screen and surround sound at home, and every piece of content in the world is available, legally or illegally, for people at the moment. That, like, if we don't actually keep going to the cinemas, then there'll be nothing but Jurassic Park on IMAX.
Yeah, and it's a funny one. Like, people often talk about the cinema like, oh, it's got a bit expensive, the tickets are a bit more than they used to be and stuff like that. But I just think, like, I know there were years of work that people are putting into these films, or in the case of those bigger films, like, where are you going to get something that costs 300 million available to you for 15 quid? You know, so, like, to me, it's like one of the best experiences you can have for under 20 euro, and go along and, or, you know, bring your family or go with friends or whatever it might be. Like, it's still, I mean, and that's why I'm in what I'm in, because I love it. Like, that's me. But maybe we have got to, like, and it's completely normal. And obviously we had COVID and, you know, no one wants to talk about that, but it got us more used to sitting on the couch and, yeah, and watching amazing stuff that's being made for, you know, the streamers and so on.
I suppose that's why I was asking about the comeback of the documentaries. I've been...
Sure.
Blue Road, the Edna O'Brien documentary, has done really well in the UK, and there's kind of this sense that there's a movement of people actually happy to go out, and their Friday entertainment is going to be going to see documentaries like yours.
Yeah, you hope so. But I think, like, no one should be told you have to go to the cinema and you have to support films. They should go and see them because they want to.
And because
they read the review and they go, you know, that film got a great review and it's obviously really good, and that's going to be an enjoyable evening, and I'm going to get out of the house and go and see that. Like, you know, you kind of, I almost, like, would never regret going to the cinema. I think most people feel like that. Yeah. Sometimes it's just that little bit of extra effort to go and do it. But yeah, like, the effort that's got, like, the competition out there for docs even alone, like, you know, you mentioned Edna O'Brien films, absolutely brilliant, you know, and you go, like, that's another Irish doc. As I said, there's 50, like, I was looking at all the films that were getting nominated for awards last year, Irish documentaries. There must be 10 plus Irish documentaries that got won awards or got nominated for awards either here or elsewhere. Same is happening this year. Like, there's a quality there, I think, that has risen over the years, and that's just pushing everyone up. Like, you know, like sports, the more competition it is, the standards go higher.
On that, right, I've been thinking a little bit about how there's a call at the moment for us to fund football, and everybody's like, well, the industry should be able to fund itself. There's so much money sloshing around, UEFA, FIFA, etc. But actually, what we really need is an injection of cash now, and you can claw that back in years to come. The film industry has done a good job of organising funding in a way that has helped the industry grow. I do wonder, though, am I oversimplifying it by saying this has been successful? Because I talk to people in the film industry and they're like, we actually need way more support and we need more government help.
Well, everyone always wants more support.
It's true.
That's true. I mean, yeah. But I suppose, look, and it would be the same for football and League of Ireland, I presume you're talking about. And if you put money into things, that a lot of times there's, like, an exponential value if you spend it well. Do you know what I mean? And that definitely goes, like, if you look at the money that's gone into Irish language cinema in particular, maybe a little bit more than Irish language TV, like, the films that are coming out have been really, really successful, you know, and obviously there's almost like an outlier or a particularly successful film in Cullen Braid's Colleen Kuhn. So if you get behind something, I think the key to it generally with these things is that you do it for a period of time. You know what I mean? If you put money into something for a year or two, you'll get nothing. I mean, I think the huge one that we should be looking at is women's sports. You look at the relay team, a few years of support and they're up there, you know, almost winning medals in the Olympics. Like, that's the highest, highest level of sport. And, you know, I don't know what those women are, you know, what grants they're getting, but I'm sure it's not even that much, you know. So, like, you get behind things and it will have a value. And women's sport to me is the most obvious one, because you want to keep girls in sport, they need people to look up to. They're going to look at, you know, Charlene Mosey and Rashida and everyone winning medals. They're going, like, I want to be like that, you know. And the same goes for women's Gaelic games. Like, you know, I don't know if you're watching the GA and the Camogie over the weekend, but we had brilliant hurling matches, but the Camogie matches were brilliant as well. You know, I was watching those too, and I just thought, like, God, you need to get behind all of this. But there's only so much to go around, you know, and the people listening to this are the people that are funding it, essentially, and they should always remember that too. It's taxpayers' money, you know. So, yeah, but definitely, we've seen that in film, and it's definitely will be the case in sport too.
What was your first documentary? Was it Saviours?
Yeah, that was 2007. So that was... Oh, at the time I was working with a good pal, Liam Nolan, and we were like, where would we find a story in Dublin? Because we had no money and we actually had no support at the time, and we had a camera and a microphone, and we said, like, what, you know, we call them precincts now. That's the kind of buzzword in documentary and stuff. It's like, what environment can we go into and just make a film about that place that would lead to there being lots of stories? And we kind of came up with the idea of an inner city boxing club. And ultimately it was the most fascinating place. And, you know, we were there for about just under a year and a half. Turned out Darren Sutherland was one of the boxers in there, you know, and we followed them for a year and a half, and you did sort of see such twists and turns within the lives of the young men that were there. So that was the first one. Yeah, that was 2007.
Obviously, you didn't just decide that you wanted to do that. You'd had an interest in it to get to the point where you were able to make something like that.
Yeah, no, it was very green, I have to admit, like, even back then, but I suppose, like, I don't know, for whatever reason, I'm just someone who just wants to get up and do things, you know. And so I had got a loan out and bought a camera, and then intersected with Liam, as I mentioned, and he kind of had the same mentality, or I maybe egged him on a bit. And we just went out and started filming and filming and filming, and it was brilliant because we had jobs, you know, like day jobs. I was working as a travel agent at the time, actually, and we would go, but, you know, the training sessions, which is often the case, is like Tuesday night, Thursday night, Friday night, and then they might have either, you know, boxing tournaments or additional training sessions the weekend. So you could kind of do it around work.
Yeah.
So we just started doing it, and as we went along, tried to keep an idea of how the stories were going. And ultimately, in the end, we eventually persuaded the film board to give us a little bit of finishing money, and they did, and they were hugely supportive, and ended up making it into a feature doc. And that was kind of the beginning of this crazy 15 years, which sometimes I wonder what have I been up to at all. But anyway,
how did you know how to use the camera and stuff like that? Like, just the basics.
Practice, definitely just practice, like, learn on the job. And just like anything, you know, I mean, you know, this is getting a bit technical, but like I always say to any young filmmakers, is like, learn a skill, either learn how to use the camera or learn how to use the microphone or learn how to edit, because then you'll actually have something you can make. You can make something with that, you know what I mean? Or you're of value to somebody. So
you can get on shoots and see other people do
stuff.
Yeah,
exactly. And sometimes then when I started getting a bit more into it, even off the back of Saviours around the same time, I come in as like a, you know, production assistant or assistant producer on other people's work. And because I was able to shoot camera, I would be like, oh, will you do a bit of second camera? And yeah, that kind of led to me getting work alongside the stuff I was trying to do. And yeah, then, you know, if you're just doing something, your experience grows and grows and grows really quickly.
Can I just, what were you consuming at the time?
In terms of films, and stuff like that? Yeah, I mean, the early, it's a long time ago now, but like the ones that stood out, like obviously When We Were Kings, I watched when I was a kid, and that was just like really stood out. And that was probably the one thing that made me think, oh God, there's documentaries in the cinema. And I found that film just really, I suppose, like powerful. A Year Till Sunday was a big one, you know. Some guy just was there with a camera in a dressing room and made this fantastic film. So that was like a huge inspiration, you know what I mean? And there were other things like there was the Chavez documentary about the coup. The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, which won like the best TV program in the year, in the world that year. It was phenomenal. And I just happened to see it by chance. I was on a kind of like a J1 style thing in Canada, and I went to a festival, and it wasn't even in the festival, it was in a side thing. Anyway, it went on to be so successful. So all those films really stood out for me. And I mean, the gas thing, I don't know if you've ever, you guys have probably done it, but like the whole background of When We Were Kings was, you know, the way it came out in the 90s, but it was shot in, I think that fight was 72. So I'd always assumed like that they'd had all this footage and then they went back and then they made the film. But actually the guy had been trying to make it for 20 years. And I was like, well, that actually rings a bell now, you know. But yeah, so all those things stood out and then you kind of learn the stories behind them. And yeah, if you, in my case, I found that really inspiring.
Even though it's like a lifetime of people saying, no, we're not going to give you money for this. What are you doing? Why are you trying to make this film? It's crazy. No one's going to watch it.
Yeah.
And then you make it like, oh, I knew it was always going to be a success all along.
Yeah, you do. It's funny when you get, like, this is a really good example in Beat the Lotto, which, you know, we're getting great reviews and people are loving it in cinema, but, and it seems like such a no-brainer now to make it, you know, but, and I'm talking about it and saying to you guys, like, oh yeah, like it's got all the perfect elements of a film or a documentary and but actually along the way we managed to be turned down by pretty much every funding body we were eligible for. So yeah, it's, I think it's one of those things where sometimes your determination convinces other people, or your desire to keep it going, your belief in the project. And I suppose, like, I mean, again, if this is interesting to people listening, but certainly I found that, like, a lot of times with funding, it's just bad timing. Do you know what I mean? It's not necessarily a bad idea or they don't like it. It's just sometimes it's the timing. And if you stick with something, that timing can sometimes come back around to you.
Do you have loads of other projects on the go?
Yes.
That are similarly of age, like you've been working on for such a long period of time?
No, I've got a bit more ruthless now. No, yeah, I tend to try and sort of figure out a bit more quickly which are the ones that have an opportunity to be financed, because now I have a mortgage and children and stuff like that. I have to think about it a little bit differently.
Yeah, okay. Let's get to your list, right?
Oh, yeah.
Were you drawn to Saviors because you were a sports fan already, or did this awaken? Did well? I suppose you first you went straight to two sports documentaries when we asked you for. So you obviously love sport,
yeah,
the whole time.
Yeah, I love all sports, you know, and it just seemed to me always that, like, there is stakes in sport, like in terms of, you know, the person usually is striving to achieve a particular thing, and that really gives any film that you make an engine. You know what I mean? It's like, this is where you're going with it. It's taking you in a certain direction. At the end, it'll lead somewhere, and then you're looking for what are the stakes elsewhere in the person's life that you can sort of build into it, or what are the other layers to this story. So sport is, on one level, like, such a great area for documentary making. So I think my love of sport combined with that sort of obvious storytelling elements really led me towards sport. Yeah, definitely.
So did you play sport as a kid?
Not very well, yeah. No, I did play a lot of sports. And at the time, I thought I was okay. But in retrospect now, thinking back, I probably wasn't very good at sport.
There's nothing wrong with that realization.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, no, I loved it. Played rugby, football. Never got to play any Gaelic games because my mother, turns out, wouldn't let me. I asked her a few years ago, how come I never got to, like, go to the local GAA club? And she goes, because all my dad ever did was watch GAA, and I just didn't want it in my house every weekend. So I only sort of came to appreciating Gaelic games a little bit later. But yeah, it was, and all those sports that kids play, like tennis during Wimbledon and cycling up the hill during the Tour de France, yeah, and all those kinds of things, yeah.
So when you were making your list, what was the hierarchy of stuff? Was it like...
So what's on the list again?
Katie Taylor's first pro fights.
Oh, yeah.
First pro title, so sorry, not first fight.
You had to be there. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, Katie, that was just... Like, obviously, I was lucky enough. And again, it was timing more than anything, and just... What had happened with Katie was a couple of things. She had seen Saviors. So she actually went to see Saviors twice in the cinema.
Right.
So yeah, there you go. That's a challenge to anyone. Beat the Lotto this week. Be the one to go see it twice. But no, so that background helped. And then I had done a bit of filming for a doc about Bernard Dunne. And Brian Peters was Bernard's manager at the time. So the kind of confluence of those factors of Brian becoming Katie's manager, and then me having done Saviors, which Katie had liked, kind of... One thing led to another really quickly, and I got to make the documentary with Katie. Like, it literally happened. I got a call, and the next day we were filming her first press conference. But then...
Does something like that get financed quickly just because everybody knows?
Yeah, I mean, that was the easiest one to finance. And also, we had good access, and some of the early footage we got was really great. So we were able to show that. And you still start off with nothing, and you're a little bit on a wing and a prayer. But obviously, with Katie, you'd have a certain amount of confidence, and she's so fascinating and so brilliant.
I don't want to derail from the list as well, but that point you said about starting with nothing, it's fascinating to me, because you envision the idea of a film like that. how you conceptualize it. Like, is it completely just step by step by step? Or are you working to some broader objective, some greater kind of whole? You know kind of what you're aiming towards, because it comes into all things. When you're talking about the financing even, I don't know, like, almost like a symphony or something. I don't know how you pitch something from a scratch when there's so many little different bits to it when it's all finished. That conjunction, I just cannot get my head around it.
Yeah, and the tricky thing is, like, to answer your question properly, is that you kind of don't know, because you are, especially with something where you're following a story, anything could happen. Like, I mean, it didn't happen, but, like, you know, in Katie's third pro fight, she could have broken her leg in some kind of freak accident and been out of the sport for a year, and then you'd be screwed, you know what I mean? So, like, there is an element of trust with the funders, but what you do is you lay out an idea of where you think the story's going. And in Katie's case, it was like, you know, obviously things that happened in her family life and in her sporting life. She'd lost at the Olympics. She was on the comeback trail. She wanted to see if, she, you know, the, I suppose behind the scenes, the idea was, like, can she kind of put women's pro boxing on the map? So there was a lot of kind of obvious enough themes with that from the beginning that she's aiming towards. Do you know if that's going to work out or not? I suppose you're thinking within the pro sport, it'll be a while until she meets someone that's going to be her match at that point. There were some really good people around at her weight division, but they seem to be scattered, like, you know, away to bowl. You know what it is like with boxing is that people sort of go to the place where they think they're going to win a title. But, you know, within a few kilos either side of her, and she's gone on to meet people like that, like Chantelle Cameron and obviously Amanda Serrano, who she's fighting again this weekend. But you knew she'd get a certain way down the trail towards winning a pro world title. So, you know, you had a certain amount of confidence with that, and then there's enough going on the other layers. So in that case, you'd find it reasonably easy to pitch. But sometimes it's extremely hard because people just do not know what's going to happen within a story. Sometimes that's why the retrospective stories about something that happened, say, 20 years ago, where you know what happened, but you can also put it in cultural context. Like, if you look at 30 for 30 on ESPN, they don't do stories in the last few years.
Yeah.
All the stories are at least 20 years old, because they can say, okay, we can see the impact that this had on society and culture. So the retrospective ones can sometimes be easier than the following kinds of ones. Yeah, but yeah, coming back to the list, I suppose, yeah, being in the dressing room when Katie Taylor won her first pro fight, you did have to be there. You know what I mean? Like, that was a really, really special moment to see that. And also, she'd actually been sick as a dog the whole week, like really, really unwell. So, you know, again, she would never say that, and no one around her would ever say that. Like, she wouldn't see that as an excuse. She'd never make an excuse for anything. And as you know, athletes often carry a lot of injuries and sicknesses and stuff that nobody knows about. But being there and seeing what she went through that week, and then to go on and win the title, was pretty special.
How many of you are in your team? You and a camera person, you and a camera and a sound person, just you?
In that situation? Like, well, there's obviously, like, in behind the scenes, there'd be a wider, small team. Like, I work a lot with my friend Adina Sullivan, and we work together and kind of come up with ideas together and try and figure out how to make them. In that case, say in the dressing room, it would just be me. Like, there wouldn't really be room for anyone else, you know? And yeah, it's the best way for people to sort of forget you're there is be as few as possible.
That's where learning the skills of the camera are.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, you're not hiring somebody else to do it. No, sorry, there's no room for you. There's no room for your cameraman. You're like, what?
Yeah, exactly. And people also, like, when you think about it, say with Katie or anything like that, where you're following them, you want to be able to go everywhere she goes, you know, at the drop of a hat. So, like, you know, you're in a press conference and suddenly an opportunity comes up for her to go and meet someone or whatever. You want to be able to, like, jump in the car. If you've got three or four people and another vehicle parked around the corner and all this kind of stuff, then you just can't have that kind of flexibility. So there's something really nice about just having the camera yourself and off you go.
Do you mic her up?
Yeah.
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 So she's mic'd up.
She's mic'd up. Usually you'd have one or two radio mics. You put them on significant people. If someone's, you know, talking closely to someone, you can pick that up as well. But yeah,
when you take that off, like, when
you never want to take it off. Like, no, on fight day she wouldn't wear one, but on the days leading up to it, yeah, we would have had one on her, obviously not in the ring but elsewhere.
Okay, so that was first on your list. Shane winning at Portrush. Now, this is our opportunity, I think, to talk about the film that's coming out Thursday night in Sky. It's all the Irish winners of the Open.
Yeah, all Ireland's major winners since 1947. So, you know, it was one of those where I work with a guy called Bob Caldwell on a couple of golf-related projects, and, like, he would have really good connections in the golf world, and obviously I've made a doc with Shane and stuff like that. So we sort of had this idea to do something about Ireland's Open winners, because it's pretty incredible how many Opens we've won over the last less than 20 years. I think only the US, you know, has won more than us, which is incredible when you think of the golfing culture of Scotland, England, you know, Spain, Australia, South Africa, all those countries, you know, have incredible golfing traditions. But we just seem to have been pretty special over the last 20 years. So the idea came, you know, usually sort of Golf Channel and Sky and stuff that would like to broadcast a golf-related documentary around the Open Championship. So we pitched this, which was, you know, let's have a little bit of a look into why it is that Ireland has won so many Opens, but from the points of view of the people that have done it, which, you know, at the time seemed great and it did turn out well, but in retrospect, like actually getting all five of our major winners from the last 20 years was fine, but probably actually a bit of a win to get them all. Yeah, so, I mean, and it turned out really well. I mean, and it was great, you know, to interview Rory and Shane and Padraig and Graham McDowell and then obviously Shane, and then Paul McGinley makes a great contribution as well. He's so knowledgeable. So, you know, it was really, I suppose, them telling their story in their own words across an hour of television and, yeah, and sort of thinking themselves a little bit about why this has happened.
So that's out on Thursday?
Thursday night on Sky Sports, yeah.
When you were doing the Shane documentary, was that a retrospective or were you following?
Yeah, it was. I was up at the Open. I got tickets for my dad's 70th birthday and went up with my dad, my mum, my dad's friend, and we went up for the Saturday and Sunday. And
just as fans?
Just as fans, yeah. And like, would have been a huge fan of Shane's anyway. So like to be there when he won, I mean, it was, anyone who was watching on TV or has seen the clips will know it was absolutely crazy, you know.
And I think the Saturday is the greatest individual Irish sports performance because he crushes the field.
Yeah, an hour.
He just smashes them.
Absolutely destroys them in an hour, you know what I mean? It is incredible what he did. But all, like, you know, if I sometimes wonder, do we actually realise what they've achieved? You know, if we'd five Irish people winning major tennis tournaments in the last, yeah, 18 years, would we think about it a little bit differently? I don't know. I mean, maybe golf there's huge numbers play golf and maybe it's a little bit more niche, but the achievements are absolutely incredible.
It's a preposterous level of success.
It is preposterous,
It's off the charts. Like.
So in this, we get to talk to all of them about it, which was really cool.
So what was Shane's documentary was retrospective where you could just sit down and...
Yeah, so I sort of was driving back from Portrush and just thinking like, oh my God, like he's got such a great story, you know, and to come up and do this and do it at home and put it in the context of us having the Open on Irish soil, you know, like putting all that together was like, you know, so then I just had to try and track him down, which took a while. But I went, I crashed. I probably was ringing you, actually. I was ringing everyone I knew in sports and saying where, because usually... People may not realize, but usually when something good like that happens, within a week or so, there'll be some kind of press day. And I'd witnessed that through other documentaries and stuff. So I was getting on to everyone saying, like, when is there going to be a Shane Lowry press day and where is it going to be and so on. Eventually found out about 10 minutes before it started that it was on, and I cycled up there onto Leeson Street and crashed the press day and eventually got talking to Shane's manager and... started a conversation that led to making a documentary with him, yeah.
What's in it for someone like him?
Like, well, if you want to know my pitch to him.
Yeah, there's obviously an ego side to it, but like when they have, I kind of wonder what's, because if they're weighing everything up, the risk assessment on it, that is probably, it's not going to be negative, but it's still kind of, they're opening themselves up when there's probably no need to.
Yeah, I suppose like in that case, it's very celebratory, isn't it? But they, you know, my pitch to them would be in that kind of case is like, and I've definitely experienced this over the years, is people's memories of these things fade actually pretty quickly.
Okay.
You know, and within a few couple of years, you can remember it quite differently. And also like the moment has sort of passed in terms of getting the documentary made. You know, it's like if you go there 3 years later and say, hey, we want to make a documentary about Shane winning the Open. There's been two or three Open winners since, you know. So I suppose it's kind of a timing thing where, you know, I was saying to Shane, do it now while it's all fresh in your mind and while everyone's excited about it. And also we'll be able to get the finance to make it, which means it'll actually happen. And yeah, those sort of factors together. And as it happened, like Conor Ridge was very open to the idea and very supportive, along with Brian, who's still Shane's manager now. But they had done a doc with Graham McDowell. He had been Graham McDowell's GMAX manager as well. And after he had won the US Open, I think BBC Northern Ireland had done a doc with GMAC and they'd been really happy to have captured the moment. So that sort of helped as well, yeah.
That makes sense. People's memory is, and the people around you at the time as well, as it turns out, aren't always around in the aftermath of these great successes.
True.
Ireland beating the All Blacks for the first time at Lansdowne Road.
Yeah, that was amazing. I was sitting beside Sam Whitelock's dad.
All right.
By pure chance. I'd been to the one in Chicago at work and then, but there was something about that one. I mean, I had a brilliant time there and like good friends there and so on. And we had a great time in Chicago and everything. But I always wondered if the All Blacks were fully on the job for that game. You know, I remember seeing them, they were going around, you know, they're sort of being shown around Chicago the whole time and getting their pictures taken and all this kind of thing. And then it felt a little bit like we had ambushed them, you know. But then, you know, a couple of years later, it felt like, you know, they knew exactly all about us and we're definitely coming to the game in a different frame of mind. And then, you know, in my own life, some significant things that happened around then. My daughter had been born with Down syndrome and it was a little bit of a surprise at the time, and we're sort of still coming to terms with that. I actually bumped into you in the street. I don't know if you remember that, around that exact time. So this was actually the first time I had gone out and about and gone to a match or anything like that since then. I just bought one. So I found one solo ticket on Ticketmaster and said, I'll go and see this game. And then the one solo ticket was sitting beside Sam Whitelock's dad. So I was chatting to him all the way through and I was having a great time. And Ireland were winning and it was a dominant performance. It was absolutely fantastic. And I had a very embarrassing conclusion to my conversation with Sam Whitelock's dad where I said to him, well, I suppose now we'll see in the World Cup final.
Not allowed to say that.
No, and of course I kiboshed the whole thing. Nobody
your
knows.
Fault.
That's where the Rugby World Cup went wrong. But that was the beginning of the end, I'm afraid, for the Irish rugby team.
You were with work in Chicago.
Yes.
So there's rugby documentaries here in the background as well.
No, that was just... I'm going to have to like mention another sporting brand. So I was with the 42 doing a bit of filming with Marie Kinsella. They had some sponsorship, I think, to do some rugby related content at the time. And we'd gone over and done some bits around Chicago. Okay. Yeah.
You have done rugby documentaries, am I right?
Yeah, we did one. Again, another retrospective one. I think off the back of doing that documentary with Shane, sort of had this idea that it really works to capture these stories quite quickly after they happen. So I did a doc with the Irish team when they won the series in All Blacks, against the All Blacks down in New Zealand for the first time. Yeah. So that was fun. Yeah.
What was that like?
What happened was a guy called John Sherwin, who's actually in school with me, he had been down there with them and filmed a ton of behind the scenes content.
Okay.
So we took all of that footage and we did more filming with the team, interviewed them and so on. It was, again, just to get all the memories of that while it was fresh in their minds was fantastic. I think it's still on the RT player, actually. But, what an achievement that was. It was incredible. And I think sometimes with these things, especially in New Zealand, you know, they're happening very, very early in the morning and people aren't necessarily getting the full story around the games. They might get up early in the morning and watch the matches, but they don't get the sense of what really happened behind the scenes. So it was really enjoyable to be able to pull that together for people.
We got hammered in the first game and immediately on the field afterwards, Peter Romani, who I think was captain, was interviewed and was like, oh yeah, great test match. We'll see them again next week. And I was like, that's delusional. I mean, we got absolutely smashed here. What's he talking about? And then they come out and absolutely annihilate them in the second game. And then...
It was a funny one. The first game, I think, like, we actually hadn't played that badly and we weren't that far off them. Do you know what I mean? I mean, that's my memory of it now.
They scored four. They were in there 22-4 and they scored four times. And my reading of that was it's so easy for them to score every time they get in. But actually, yours is the correct one. Is like, actually, if we just keep them out, they're not going to score.
Exactly, yeah. You know, and it just, like, it's top-level sport, isn't it? And you guys talk about it all the time, but the margins are absolutely tiny and... They know, you know, a couple of tweaks in the right direction and those tries aren't happening. And not only, I think the good thing was that we were getting some joy against them, you know, and we were making breaks and we scored tries and so on and so forth. So they knew that they could play them and take them on. So I think, they definitely felt like it was possible to turn it around. I mean, again, losing, you know, one thing winning a series, which almost no one has ever done, another thing to do it from one test down. So I did feel like it was worth kind of documenting that and so on.
Do they engage? When they decide that they're going to be part of something like this, do they give of themselves or do you still feel like there's they kind of have to be retired before they finally fully give up themselves?
I think it depends on the player, you know, and you know, obviously we were hugely privileged just to get to do it in the first place, and you know, Andy's an open book pretty much, I think, you know what I mean, really, really open guy. Some of the players are less open than others. You find, I suppose, maybe the slightly older guys are more willing to talk, and as maybe in some cases the guys that, the players that have been born in other countries maybe have a different perspective. They've travelled the world and they've ended up here, and so on and so forth. So you're trying to bring all that together, and also we were making it while they were kind of getting ready to build up to the Six Nations. So we were hardly their priority. But yeah, generally speaking, I think they're pretty open, and certainly enough of them are open for you to be able to tell the story.
We're going way back in time to the Charlton era. Ireland beat Spain. I presume this is Lansdowne Road. Is this the own goal? Is
that a... Yeah, Mitchell own goal. Yeah. I mean, I don't remember a whole lot about it. What year was that? 89.
So,
yeah,
for 1990, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think that was in the... we used to go after school. We were in primary school, and we'd go on Wednesday after school. We were out in Bray, so we'd hop on the dart and go into town and go to the matches. And literally, I think the first game I went to with my friends was probably like the Wales game, which I think was the first game of the Charlton era. And then we'd gone to a few of the games. We got to Euro 88, and then going to... but we actually, I don't think we'd won a home game like against a major opposition.
No.
We'd beaten Malta.
We're not on a Charlton. I mean, we'd beat France and famously, but like...
Yes, in the own hand era, there were some incredible results. But the Charlton one was a bit different. But then beating Spain just felt to me at the time like, oh, we can actually mix it with some of the big teams here. And started to sort of believe that the Irish team was on a really great trajectory, and just felt like a really special one to be at.
Your last one is also France winning the World Cup in 98. So football is a big thing for you. Have you made many football documentaries?
No, not really. I mean, football is very tricky in terms of access. You know, even like... Well, first of all, like, you know, the Irish soccer team's golden era was kind of before I've been making documentaries. So I've done a documentary with the women's team, which I think was a brilliant experience. I absolutely loved them. And that was a fantastic experience on, you know, I'd love to be involved in docs about, you know, Premier League teams maybe and stuff like that, but never going to happen, you know, not from the base of Dublin. But yeah, it's... So yeah, in terms of the World Cup in 98, I'd bought tickets to go and stay in France. I ended up working in a bar and living there for most of the year. And then we didn't qualify. But that night when France won, I wasn't at the match, but I was working in the pub, and it was just the most... We were right in the middle of Paris and just seeing a whole...
Was it one of the Irish pubs?
Yeah, it was called Cars. Which is quite close to the Louvre and stuff like that. And that night, a bunch of interesting people came into the pub. Ali McCoist, Alex McLeish, Lisa Stansfield, and John Motson. So we were serving them and then ultimately drinking with them later on that night. And yeah, that, you definitely had to be there for that. Like, that was great fun. So like, Ali McCoist was absolutely hilarious. And he was in with a couple of Scottish lads, not famous footballers or anything like that, and they drank the place dry. It was unbelievable. But I remember Ali goes to me, first of all, you know, you have that thing where you know you recognize someone but you don't know where you know them from, and then he comes over and I'm like, oh fuck it, oh no, I know this person from somewhere, and then he said, listen, I'm not going to do a Scottish accent, but you know, we're going to be having a fair few pints of Guinness here, so they take a while to pour. So when I want another round for the lads, I'm just going to give you a nod, all right? And I was like, yeah, no problem. So he takes his 3 pints, walks over, puts them down, turns around and nods at me. And I was like, oh, wow, this is going to be a long night. So, yeah, but then, and then we had Lisa Stansfield singing later on in the pub. So, yeah, definitely a memorable night.
Was there a connection?
No, just by chance. I guess the whole world converged on Paris that weekend. And because we were central, people were just happening across the pub.
Yeah.
John Motson was there. I think it was his 30th birthday. He already seemed to me like he'd been around forever.
60th birthday, you know? John Motson, 30 in 98?
No, that couldn't be right, is it? But it was it was less of a birthday than I expected anyway.
Maybe
40th, maybe?
Did he die recently?
He did, yeah.
Yeah. I think he was about
someone do the numbers on that.
That's what's that, 30 years ago.
You find out.
Maybe it was his 50th birthday.
Yeah,
that, or maybe that it was no significant birthday, and I'm just remembering it wrong. So anyway,
yeah,
it was a good night.
Made it hazy. 50, yeah.
Okay. 50th birthday. There you go.
Tickets are available now in all good cinemas.
Yes, absolutely. And we have a website called beatthelottofilm.com where we have a list of them all. So that's the easy place to go and find one close to you. But it's in 17 cinemas around Ireland, so it's quite well spread out. Yeah, and go see it because people are absolutely loving it.
That was a classic. You had to be there. Ross, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
We will see you tomorrow, folks.
Off the Ball Breakfast.
With UPMC Orthopaedic Care. When things don't move, rotate or bend like they used to, choose us to help you get back in action.
Off the Ball Breakfast.
I have not seen a minute of this tournament.
That's the, what the cool kids say these days.
Genuinely haven't.
Saying that.
Hasn't.
I haven't seen a second of it.
It's not a thing. It hasn't even...
Live every weekday morning from 7:30 on your smart speaker. Just ask Alexa to play OTB Sports Radio.